Cool. My name's Dana Olson, as you may have figured out. Educated as an aeronautical engineer, emphasis in control system design. That means you have to work at Boeing 9 years, so I did that. They threw me out, and about 1995, and then I got a chance to go work in medical devices at Physio-Control, where I designed, well, as they said it, they're high-voltage power supplies and an excuse to use them, so defibrillators. You can imagine what practical jokes look like at that company. So I worked on, digital signal processing there and such things, then ended up at Cypress Semiconductor, worked there for 6 years and designed capacitive sensing controllers for touch screens and buttons and things like that. So if you have a touchscreen phone, you probably know what I worked on. There you go. And retired 3 years ago and decided to focus on learning how to design speakers, and someday maybe I'll make one that I can sell to you guys. And you'll all buy one, right? Okay, cool. So I tell my wife. So, you're quitting to do what? Yeah. So, impedance of loudspeakers. So I got this email and it said, hey, show some plots of impedance curves, perhaps even measure one actively live, then talk about what these curves mean, how they are used, and what effect a 4 versus 8 ohm speaker has on an amplifier performance. So, starting with that, I created this. Those are all my questions I'm going to try to answer. What is it? How is impedance measured? Why does impedance matter? Reactance in a speaker? Well, is it different than what you guys just saw? Yeah. I'm going to do some example measurements, see how it can affect the performance of your amplifier. And lastly, what do you do with that measurement after you've got it? You use it when you're designing your passive crossover, and you can look at resonance artifacts. So as you are familiar, this is, my laser pointer is not going to do anything. So perfect.
Not with the screen. Yeah,
that's all cool. So here's a little example of a picture of a speaker.
There's a big one over there.
Someone's going to
jump
over this.
It'll be me. Whoa, hello. We're good. Okay. Yeah. So a speaker has a coil. So as you saw in earlier presentations, coils form inductance. And that can give you inductive reactance, and that can be a feature of a speaker's impedance. So the coil is shown here wrapped around a bobbin. This is a speaker cut in half. And then there's some steel in here. There's some magnets. Such arrangement that you get magnetic lines of flux going right through here. So this forms a linear motor. So it moves in a line up and down, pushing the cone. What keeps it centered is a spring in the form of some old kind of epoxied fabric of mysterious ingredients that manufacturers don't want to tell you about, and they call that a spider. And so that is a spring. The cone is a mass, so you basically have a nice spring and mass system. So this is an additional place to store energy in the motion of that mass, its momentum, and the displacement of that spring. So because your motor is attached to that, it gives you another system to store energy to create an impedance. There's also a surround, which is just kind of an air seal. It has some properties. They'll be fabric, they'll be coated fabric, they'll be foam, they'll be rubber. They will have a little bit of a spring constant to them. They will also have what's called viscoelasticity, which means that it will move a little bit like a liquid, like a very, very thick liquid. So you can push on it and displace it, and it will provide a force like a spring would, but then that force may like subside as the thing gets sort of happy with its new displacement. So that all said means it's a nonlinear type of spring. The spider is also a nonlinear type of spring. And so that means that its force, instead of linearly or proportionally increasing with displacement, it may, as the thing stretches and changes shape, the force it returns per increment of motion may reduce. So you'll see it start to, its force won't continue to go up in a straight line like you'd want it to. It will just kind of taper off. And then eventually this will all get stretched out so it's straight. And then all of a sudden it will just become very, very stiff as it just can't, you're down to stretching the actual material itself instead of bending the material. So these are all properties that we will look into a little bit as we proceed. So what is it? What's impedance related to a speaker? It's, as we said before, a frequency-dependent opposition or resistance and reactance to the flow of charge, which people talk about as a current, through the motor coil of the loudspeaker. And so I have a example plot here of the impedance, this lower line of a typical speaker. This is kind of a full range speaker. You can see what's happening here. The upper part of the curve, see the impedance rises. That's because that is looking at the inductance of the voice coil. You see a resonant peak here, and that's because of our mechanical assembly. So it mechanically resonates at whatever this says, a couple hundred hertz, about 300. So this happened to be a small driver. It's a little 1-inch full range driver, kind of like what you'd find if you tore this TV apart. All right.
What's the red curve?
The red curve is the phase. So as they talked about, the phase of the impedance has to do with where the current is related to the voltage. So I don't go into that in depth, but if it's a resistor, the peak of the voltage curve, so if you're putting in a sine wave, right, you put a voltage in a sine wave, if you looked at the current curve on a resistor, if you measured that, okay, I'm putting voltage across the resistor, how much current's flowing through the resistor, the current would just look like the same sine wave as the voltage sine wave, right? So now you say, I'm going to add this impedance, which is going to imply some storage element, and it causes a delay, and it can either be a, they call it a lead or a lag, but it will shift the current sine wave away from the voltage one, either ahead of it or behind it. And the, if you think of this, you know, 360 degrees to go through the full sine wave, this is measured in degrees, and it shows over here, you know, here's zero. It's a little bit hard to see, but zero's in the middle. So you'll see it kind of starts off at zero, because down at the closer to DC, I think you get down to 1 or 2 hertz down here, it looks just like a resistor. Then you get up in frequency, and then you'll see some phase shift coming in as you approach this resonance, and you'll see phase shift show up as you get into the inductive area. And so it's going up towards, ultimately the inductor will get you whatever it is, 90 degrees, and I guess the capacitor would get you minus 90 degrees if we had a, we'll play with that when we do some measurements later. But all right, so how would you measure the impedance of a speaker? So this is straight out of the LIMP user manual, which is some software that you can get off the internet and either use it free or pay a modest amount of money. And I highly recommend you look at it if you're thinking about doing this sort of work. So it shows the speaker on the far right there. Then you have a resistor in series with it that we use to make measurements. We make two measurements, U1 and U2. Those are voltages. And you have a signal generator basically on the left. So it, this generator can generate all the frequencies you want to measure the impedance at. And by looking at those two voltages, you can derive the impedance. Now, when you work on your presentation too quickly and too close to when you give it, you forget the order. Just a little note for you future presenters out there. Okay. But, oh, hey, this is what I wanted. So, so you see, I had U1 and U2. Those are the measurements we make, right? So you get, how, Dana, how do I get the impedance from two voltage measurements? This is how you do it. Okay, so they use, you know, U for voltage, V, Z for R. You swap those around a little bit here. So you go, oh, well, my impedance Z is U divided by I, voltage divided by current. That's by definition. So then we've got in this circuit, the same current that's going to go through R is going to go through our speaker. Agreed? Cool. So then we can, if we measure the current through the resistor, we will know the current through the speaker. So then we go, oh, okay, well, what would the current through the resistor be? It would be I equals U over R. What's the voltage across the resistor? Let's go look. It's the difference between those two voltages. Fantastic. We're on page. Then we can say, all right, so then what's the current? Well, it would be that voltage divided by the actual resistor. So we know the value of that resistor. We put it in there. And 1 over that current would be 1 over that. And then you combine those and you get the impedance of your speaker in terms of the measurements you've made. U2, U1, U2, and R. So what's just a very simple circuit, which I have created right here with two cables, a resistor, and some clip leads. So plugged into the side of my laptop. So I have a total investment here of $8. So you can afford to make this. Here's the schematics of what I built. Again, stolen directly from the LIMP manual, giving credit where credit is due. So I did this one here, attached to the side of my laptop. I also, and you say, well, gee, that's really nice. Why would you want to do anything else? Sometimes you want to measure those nonlinearities of the speaker, which happen when you're really swinging a lot of power into it. So this is only able to drive a headphone. So it's, I don't know, 100 milliwatts or something, right? So over here I have a setup with a 35-watt amplifier where I built, and it's really the same, just a little variation on the theme. We can use a lower resistance reference resistor, and then resistive dividers because the voltages that you're measuring now are higher than the sound card can take in, so you might have a 10-to-1 ratio there. All that stuff fits in the little aluminum box over here. But I thought, boy, people are going to look at that and they go, gosh, I can't make that. That's complicated. So you can make this. Okay, there you go. Relax, it's going to be fine. Okay, why does impedance matter? You say, that's great, you got the impedance of a speaker here, and I don't care. So this is why it matters. So you ready? Here we go. Okay, sound pressure, which I'm going to call P, is equal to a constant, that's big and complicated, somebody here probably knows, times the acceleration of the cone. All right. Acceleration of the cone. Now, all good lectures when I was in college had F equals MA in it. So, okay, F equals MA, rearranged, solve for A. So the force of the motor divided by the mass of the cone. The force of our motor comes from B, which is the strength of our magnet, L, the length of our wire, and I, the current we put through our wire. See, so now we go, well, what determines the current that comes through our wire? The current is equal to the voltage divided by the impedance, Z. So you have this relationship directly that 1 over the impedance is going to impact the pressure you get out of your speaker, right? So what happens when your impedance goes up and down as it goes across the frequency range? The output of your speaker goes up and down. And I don't think we like that. So we need to understand that. There you go. So voltage output amplifiers, the kind 99% of you have, rely on the speaker's impedance to perform the voltage to current conversion, right? So that's basically what's happening. go, oh, okay, I really want this current, but I have this amplifier that puts out a voltage. How's it going to turn into a current? The impedance of the speaker. All right, so mentioned, so we drive a fixed voltage across the frequencies. The impedance is going to make a change. There's another kind of amplifier you can get that has a current output. So instead of regulating to a voltage ratio on the voltage you put in, they have a transconductance amplifier. And what it does is it says, oh, if you put 1 volt in, I'm going to put 1 amp out. And vice versa, you know, varies. And so if you use that, it could care less about the impedance. It's going to go directly, drive an I, and it's going to be flat, regardless of the speaker's impedance. Mm-hmm. So these are popular for that reason and others, but with some trouble, but anyway.
Linearity has nothing to do with that, right?
But it also doesn't give you the control over your driver that you're going to want, potentially at that resonance we saw earlier. Okay, passive crossovers. So when you design passive crossovers out of coils and capacitors, they are relying on the impedance being a fixed value across the range they're operating for them to actually give you the designed slope you're looking for. So you're saying, oh, I want a 6 dB slope per octave. Well, if your impedance is changing through the range, you're expecting that to roll off. It may go up, it may go down, but you're not going to get what you hoped for unless you compensate for that. Lastly, amplifier distortion can depend on speaker impedance. So we will get into that in a little bit. All right, reactance in a speaker. So this idea that electrically, it's this idea that you are storing and releasing energy periodically throughout the waveform, right? That's what gives you impedance, as opposed to just resistance, where you just say, I'm just going to block this. The impedance comes about because you've stored a little bit of energy, and then you release it later on in the waveform. So how can that happen? Of course, with the field and the capacitors. If you have a capacitor related to the speaker, an actual speaker itself has very low capacitance, probably nothing you'd notice in itself. Of course,
unless it's electrostatic.
Yeah, there you go. That's a good one. Thank you. That's awesome. Yeah. Energy stored in magnetic field in the inductor. Sort of related to that, not necessarily stored, but a speaker can act as a transformer because it's got a coil next to some steel. And elsewhere in the steel, eddy currents can form and look like resistance seen through a transformer. So these are sort of odd things that show up that you have to think about. Electromechanically, so this is where it gets interesting. We have our linear motor coupled to our mechanically resonant structure. So we're storing energy, kinetic energy in the moving mass, potential energy in the deformed spring. And then when you get to ported speakers, you add another spring and mass, which the spring being the volume of air in the cabinet and the mass of air in the port itself, or if you have a passive radiator, it's the mass of the radiator. So now you've got this spring and mass and another spring and another mass and everything jumps around. So you get this interesting multimodal behavior with two resonances effectively. So we'll see that. And one of the resonances where this is where I move the microphone as I talk, the two move together or they move in opposite directions. There we go. See that? Those are eigenvectors for the Germans in the audience. So special vectors for the rest of us. Okay.
Together other orthogonal vectors.
Yeah. So here's an impedance curve for a typical 10-inch woofer. I'm sorry if you people in the back would have to stand up because the curve kind of ended up at the bottom of the screen. I'm sorry about that. The characteristics of this curve are what we talked about before. The mechanical resonance shows up here. This one happens to be at for 35 hertz.
That's a high Q. That's like high Q driver.
It is, yeah. Yeah. So that means it has very little damping. There's friction related to the velocity of the cone. There's very little of that in this driver. So it, once you hit it, it will just kind of ring like a bell. Because this peak here is high. That means it's very efficiently storing the energy in the spring and then returning it back to you again and not dissipating it. So the impedance, instead of being down here at 8 ohms where it started, what it's doing, so when you move that coil through the magnetic field, just without connecting the speaker to anything, it generates a voltage. It's the back EMF, they call that. And so what we're experiencing here is, because the cone's moving and it's ringing like a bell, you can unhook it and it will briefly continue to ring, it will still produce a voltage. That voltage is being produced even though you're driving it. So you can imagine, here's your amplifier saying, I'm trying to put current into this thing. But it's generating its own voltage that's matching very closely the voltage I'm already putting into it. So it's like going, gee, I have a battery here with 12 volts, and I'm trying to put it into this resistor, but this resistor looks like a resistor sitting on top of a 10-volt battery. So instead of looking like I have this whole drop to put across it, it's like starting to match it, and that's why the impedance goes up. If that makes sense. Here's a dome tweeter. So its resonance is much higher. It's got a very small mass and, for whatever reason, a tight spring. Whatever, couple 1500 hertz. Again, you see the inductance of the coil causing the jump up there.
The impedance goes up to 11 ohms. I'm trying to give you some scale.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
8 to 11.
Yeah. Yeah, this one starts out at 3.6 ohms, and goes up to 11. Turn the knob to 11, JBL, yeah.
And that kind of impedance can completely mess up your crossover.
Yeah.
Because what happens is you may find out your crossover is crossing over an entire octave too low.
Thank you for the segue.
Sorry.
It's all good. this was the full range driver again, the Aura Sound. This is an odd bird. So there were 180 of these made. I own two of them. It's called an active hybrid radiator. And it's a 12-inch woofer with a 40-ohm coil. So you see, instead of starting off down here at 8 ohms like your typical speaker, this one starts at 39 and goes up from there. And so the idea of this was to make a passive radiator that has a little bit of drive so that it helps it stay in phase with the woofer when it's resonating, and probably over a little wider range, and probably have a little better transient response. But what's the man's name? Milo?
Nestorovic.
Yes. So, I, after searching for 15 years, managed to buy a pair of those. Yes.
So what's the electronics that attach to this active passive radiator? Is it
the big pile of them?
Well, in this, so it can be a coil and a resistor and a capacitor and some. If you look at his patent, he has several different variations. I suspect this man knows. This particular one.
I'm not doing it that way on the new one.
Okay.
It's literally a bag of components to that to work reasonably. Yeah. And when it worked reasonably, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
What is that bump in at the bump there?
Well,
wiggle there.
That is possibly I'm not sure. It could be the surround. It could be the cone. I suspect it's probably not the cone bending.
Too low for cone resonance.
Yeah.
You talking about this guy?
Yeah.
To explain to other people, that's not what a second order section, which is what a loudspeaker is, looks like. And that's just why I asked.
So that's an additional second order section showing up, right?
That's what it looks like.
So there's another energy storage somewhere in that driver.
What frequency is that second order?
That's 30.
It's just 30 hertz. Yeah, it's very low.
It's like,
it could be a measurement error. It's
is that the ATS you're using?
So that particular, I was using to do these was
the ATS,
the woofer tester 3. It really does from time to time throw a bad sample in the sweep because it does a very quick sweep. But
but you always run it twice. And make it
Yeah.
That doesn't look like a bad sample though.
Yeah, so I am not sure.
See, if you look, you see the same thing in the phase. It's a,
sure, yeah, it would have to be. So then you go put a woofer. Yeah, I can't explain that, but drop by my house. We'll figure it out. Bring your strobe light. So here's a woofer in a sealed box. Here's a woofer in a ported box. What the heck happened? Hey, Danny, you said there was going to be a second resonance. And so I may or may not get this right, so I'm pretty sure you guys will tell me right if I'm screwed up. So I believe this is the resonance when the two things are moving in the same direction. And I think this is where they're moving in opposite direction. The two modes
of the
system.
Opposite directions is higher frequency.
Is it? Okay. Oh, it has to be. Yes. Because it looks like... So as they come together, it looks like the spring's tighter for the woofer. Say you have the air coming in the port. At the same time, the woofer's moving back. You've compressed the air in the volume, so it's going to look like a tighter spring, and that makes sense. Yeah. And then when they move together...
It's a very high Q system. I'm looking at this.
Right.
I mean...
Yeah.
When I do woofers, I usually try to get something where maybe I have a 2-to-1 peak, then I figure I've gotten the transient response sorted.
Uh-huh.
I'm just looking at it. That's there's no loss in that system.
No.
You're not losing any power.
No. And then the output of the port peaks, oddly enough, right between these two, which confused me greatly until I understood that, well, that's where the woofer's not moving mostly and the air's coming out of the port, but rapidly.
Well, you can say here, it's another impedance thing.
Mm-hmm.
What happens is as you go through the box resonance, the impedance of the box goes way down.
Yeah.
But way, way down. So when the driver's trying to move the air in the box, it's really hard to move, so you actually get a dip. So that's actually what it is. This is how you actually get cone control, cone displacement control in the woofer, is by creating, well, you can think of it as a really real pick. It's easier to look at an admittance, which is the inverse of impedance. But having a really high admittance spike is where the cone control comes from in a ported box. And then when you get below that, the cone control goes away and the excursion goes insane, which is why you don't run boxes at those points.
Yeah. All right. So, on to amplifiers. So, amplifiers, you'll see these curves often where the distortion is higher for a low resistance or a low impedance speaker versus a, so here's a 4-ohm speaker and an 8-ohm speaker. This is lifted from Douglas Self's book, Audio Power Amplifier Design Handbook. Highly recommend it if you want to learn how to scientifically deconstruct amplifiers stage by stage and look at alternative architectures of each stage and optimize them. If you can't sleep some night, you know, come borrow it. No, it's fantastic. Yeah. Bam. Read it to your kids. Yeah.
The irony is that's also due to impedance because when you put a smaller, more of a load on the output of the amplifier, you reduce the feedback by that change in amount and you get more.
And that's what this page says.
Oh,
you've seen this.
I'm just trying to point out that it matters an awful lot of that. And on top of that, now you have this problem, too.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And you get an additional hit from the fact that your beta goes down.
Yeah, and so these are the gains of output transistors versus current that they're driving out.
Yeah.
And so your old 2N3055 really drops off.
Terrible.
And then they said, hey, let's make a better transistor. So the MJ15024, it got a little better. And so, you know, more modern transistors have less of this. But so when you look at expensive amplifiers that drive low output impedances, you will see lots of these transistors in parallel to overcome this effect. And so it's effectively what's... So as JJ said, so what's happening is you have a nonlinear device in your amplifier. How do you linearize it with feedback? That depends on the gain. So your feedback is only as good as the amount of gain you have to make the correction. So as the gain drops in this device, the feedback is lowered and the distortion increases. So,
well, the distortion goes as 1 over 1 plus the gain. And if you make that gain half as big, the distortion goes up by a factor of 2. But it's worse than a factor of 2 because that would happen even without, you know. So you have a couple of things going on there. There's a couple effects and all of them bite you.
Right.
Which is why you use FETs. But it depends on what you're doing. They're doing a lot of things.
And this is just the same information plotted. Here he went and deconstructed the stage and looked at the change in beta incremental gain of a standard CFP output stage complementary feedback pair. Thank you.
And that's where you lose it. That's where you do worse with a FET because you cannot get the FET to handle the crossover point well.
So, of course, he did this with PSPICE. It's much more... It's much easier to probe in PSPICE than it is with your actual electronics. All right, cool. So, that you showed me how that voltage was going to screw up my crossover. So here are some quick examples. So the blue line or whatever, that is our goal. That is a typical second order crossover roll-off, and I said, hey, I want to be... whatever it was, 6 dB down at 150 hertz. And did I get there? Something. No, we got 3 dB down. Okay, there you go. I got a 3 dB down at 150 hertz. So that was the design.
First order? Yes.
I think it's 150 by 2. Yeah. So, So then what happened was my speaker had its resonance in this vicinity. So here is the speaker I did this with. So, and it's not even that close, is it? So the resonance is up here, where are we, about 37 hertz? So its impedance is rising as the frequency is dropping. So if your circuit's depending on a constant impedance to make its roll off, you're not gonna get it. So each of these, So here would be just, I just looked it up in the back of the catalog there. They said I needed a 93 microfarad capacitor and 12 millihenry choke, and that's going to give me my great crossover. And that's going to give you this one that comes out here, goes down a little bit, and then all of a sudden just flattens out. And then, and I said, we're going to roll off now. Yeah. So what you do to fix this is you correct the impedance with a network. So you can go and, especially with this software I'm using here, BoxSim, they have a little calculator, and you put in the parameters of your speaker, and then it tells you the proper network to put in there. And so now what it will do is when you measure the impedance across these two wires, it will be a constant whatever you set it to, the 6.4 ohms or whatever this driver was, from DC up to... the point where the inductance actually starts making it rise. And you can compensate that with a second network with a resistor and a capacitor in series. If you really needed it flat, usually you're working at one end of the thing or the other. But so here, this was the mid-range. So it would actually probably have to work at the other end eventually. But for this, so that's how it affects your crossover. All right.
I was going to say, can you go back to this plot? And one of the reasons this is bad is you notice that output is going a full octave down, which means you're getting four times the excursion out of the driver.
Right.
This is not good for your mid-range.
Yeah, right.
This is really not good for your mid-range. So this is one of these things that I have seen bite, including a whole lot of commercial speakers. The other thing is the way some of the people have solved it, like, I've seen some speakers where after you look at it into the crossover, some of them dropped like 2.5 ohms, and that drives your amplifier completely.
Yeah. Keeps Krell in business or people like that, right? Yeah.
My answer is buy a proper speaker. But.
Yes. So the last piece I'm going to delve into here is modeling of this speaker impedance. So Ned Thorborg fine man, has come up with semiconductors. So instead of varying with the frequency directly, it's varying with the impedance is varying. So instead of being L times J omega or whatever, it's L times the square root. So this helps you model some of these nonlinearities I talked about. Because if you just said, I'm going to model this speaker with equivalents of coils and capacitors or just pure springs and masses, you'll get a mismatch between the curve. Now, why would you want to do all this? So if you get a nice match, what you can do is you can subtract your model values from your measured values, and then what you're left with is a residue of what wasn't modeled. And this lets you see all the other resonances in your system just looking at an impedance curve, which you think, that's pretty cool. There's no microphone here. I just have a resistor, a couple of wires, and now I can hook it up and I can start to see the resonances of my box or of my...
You can see the stuff bouncing off the box. You can see the port resonance. Yeah. All sorts of things.
And so that's because your model said this was one big mass, but in reality, say for instance, your cone's a bunch of different masses with little springs between them, things like this. And so what you can see here is they've shown, here's the model and it matched. Here's the model and it matched. But out here, it doesn't match. And all of this is cone breakup modes and things like that. And so using this method, you can zoom in on the quarter ohm variations and see a lot just with this impedance measurement.
And curiously enough, when you start seeing all those cone breakups, you probably want to cut the driver off below that.
We will.
Yes, please. Well, yeah. Depends on what kind of crossover you're using.
So let's see here if we can do a quick measurement. There we go. So let's see. So this is a resistor. And to make it really exciting, it's a variable resistor. My God, it's changing. And so the characteristics. Thank you. The characteristics of a resistor are a flat frequency response.
That's even a good resistor.
Yeah, and it came from Radio Shack, soon to be out of business. Sorry.
I'm going to ask you, by the way, afterwards. I want that program.
Oh, yeah. So this is...
this is a capacitor.
So the program is called LIMP. It's part of the ARTA software package. And if you look at my references at the last slide, it'll show you the link to that. This is a capacitor. So as the frequency drops, it conducts less and less and less. So the impedance goes way up.
Frequency's good. It'll look better.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well. Yeah. I think it's 9:30 at night. We're going to move on. For the ever-flattening hind ends out in the audience. There we go. So here's a tweeter. So anyway, you can see this thing does this very quickly. What it's doing is it's playing some broadband noise.
Wow.
With
pink.
Yeah.
I like can't hear that. Consider video.
And then the last thing I'll do, let's see if I can pull this off. Can he do it? I've got another one of these. Is this it? There we go. Is it working? This is where you get into the danger zone of measurement. Run two copies of the software at the same time. My God.
Uh-oh.
Is it working? I hear something. Yeah. Come over here to the other speaker. Well, okay, I guess it's not going to behave because I don't have it calibrated correctly. But what I was hoping to show you was the idea that as you increase the amplitude, the resonance moves. So as you crank up the amplitude, with which I can do with my 35-watt amplifier, basically that curve that you saw will start to shift as it's extending the throw into the nonlinear regions where the spring gets softer and damping may increase and things like that. So and
if you do that with the woofer, you'll also actually see voice coil warming up.
Oh, yeah.
You if you take a look at really high-powered woofers, you know, the voice coil resistance can almost double.
Yeah. All right, so that's all I've got. I'm going to connect this up for the next presenter here.
Thank you, Dana. Good stuff. Any questions on this stuff? The tools to measure your stuff at home, or this ARTA program in particular, is pretty good. I mean, it's got help and very nice little program. All right. Last up is Mark, late at night.
Talk fast, Mark.
Do I have to wake up now?
Yeah, you do have to wake up.
Talk fast, Mark.
Oh, that's what it's asking me.
So save changes.
I think we can ignore that. Let's find out. We can ignore that.
Okay. Mark Rogers.
Okay, I'm gonna talk a little bit about a couple of examples of where not taking into account the impedance of the loudspeaker system can cause bizarre things, and you will never figure out what went wrong, even if you know something is wrong. But first, I want to review. This is from one of my previous talks, and the answer here is also in the previous talks from this evening. If we have a load impedance of 8 ohms on our amplifier, and we have 8 ohms of resistance in the wire, and that's not necessarily an exaggeration. What's the loss? Think carefully.
6 dB.
That's correct. That may seem counterintuitive because you're dissipating half the power in the load and half of it in the wiring. So it should be 3 dB, right? Well, what's happening is you've reduced the load on the amplifier by another 3 dB. So it's only putting out half power because it now has a 16-ohm load instead of a 8-ohm load. That becomes important when we get into some of the next things. This first pitfall occurred with a large, very well run church based in Salt Lake City who designs their sound systems there. And this happened to me, I'm dating myself here, 35 years ago or so. I was privileged to be one of 5 or 6 acoustical consultants at that time who was authorized to go around and design retrofits for their churches, of which they have many. They were doing distributed loudspeakers, which was appropriate for the type of buildings that they have. But someone in their group decided they didn't like 70-volt transformers. This was in the 80s when transformers became evil, and no one was allowed to use them for anything. So they started doing a series parallel arrangement to hook up all these speakers in the ceiling. Anybody old enough to remember the Sweet 16 craze? Oh, a couple people, oh good. This was a variation on that theme, where they put the speakers in groups of 4 and then hook up all those groups of 4 in parallel. Each group of 4 is 32 ohms, and then they parallel the groups, and they could do 8 of those in parallel and have a 4-ohm load, and the amplifier liked that. I ran into a few that were even more than that. Now, is this okay? Now, keep in mind they're using 18-gauge wiring, and some of the speaker runs are 200, 300, even 400 feet, because they're not only doing their meeting houses, but also the adjacent gymnasium, which most churches would call the cultural hall, but in this church it's a gym. And they play basketball in there too. Well, the first problem is number 18 wire is about 6.5 ohms per 1,000 feet. By the way, two things I want to point out. when you look up the wire, the resistance of wire, like in the, there's a table in the National Electrical Code, there's a table on building, there's a lot, lots of those tables. Almost all of them, but not all of them, almost all of them are per foot of conductor, not per foot of pair. So if you have a 300-foot run, you have 600 feet of wire, not 300. The second problem is when many of the calculators that are online to calculate speaker loss, my experience is about two-thirds of them give you the wrong answer because they incorrectly calculate omitting the drop in resistance. They only calculate the ratio of the voltages. So be careful. Anyway, here we have two conductors. So our total resistance in the wire is about 8 ohms. Well, that's twice what the load impedance is. What's the loss? It's pretty nasty. But it gets worse. And they said, when I questioned them about this, they said, oh, well, power's cheap. We just turn up the gain a little bit. And that makes sense, unless you've gone out and tried to tune one of these things, which I did. The load is not 4 ohms. Speakers are not 8 ohm resistors, as our previous presenters have shown most eloquently. Here's the typical impedance of a commercial ceiling loudspeaker. And you'll notice that it actually drops below 8 ohms in the middle, but look at those two peaks. The one up there that's the dome tweeter goes up to 48 ohms, 47 ohms. Okay, what's the loss at 1,000 hertz there? Pretty high. What's the loss up there at, is that 2,000 hertz, 3,000?
3 or 4K? Yeah.
Yeah. Almost nothing. Now think about that. Think about that. What is going to happen? When you go out and listen to this system, you will have two peaks in frequency response of the system. That's what you're hearing in the room that mimic the curve of the impedance. Are you going to like that? Is that going to give you good gain before feedback? Can you equalize that out? No, not really, because it's different at every loudspeaker position. And if you think about it, that's obvious. Well, I pointed this out to the people at the church headquarters who really are I felt privileged to work for them because they were they were very a very astute group, and they had a standard plan that they, our job was to adopt that standard plan to individual buildings and facilities that needed their sound system replaced. But I wasn't comfortable with this for this reason, and I pointed it out, and they said, oh, well, yeah. So, and by the way, this is the frequency response of that loudspeaker, which isn't all that good, but you could work with that. But it's not going to look like that if you install it in that room in series parallel arrangement with 18-gauge wire. Anyway, I started using 12-gauge wire on my designs. This caused them to have a hissy fit. Because 12-gauge wire is expensive. And anyway, they explained why. And they, I kind of saw the guy's face go, And then I happened to do a site survey on a building they had just redone where they used this technique, but the people, locals, weren't satisfied with the system. And the installer on that one had really gone overboard on the number of loudspeakers, and they had 1 ohm loads on the amplifier. because they had gaboons of these groups on each leg. So you can imagine what that measured and sounded like. So I made a bunch of pictures of my frequency response measurements showing that it was different in every quadrant of the building. And I sent my measurements and observations back to headquarters. Well, guess what? About a week later, they changed the standard plan to use 12-gauge wire. And then about 2 months after that, they decided, well, 70-volt transformers aren't so bad after all, which as far as I know is still the way they're doing it. Here's another little example that's using 70-volt transformers. Remember that impedance curve is going to go right through the transformer. You're going to see the same shape, not the same numbers, but the same shape on the other side of the transformer, at least if the transformer's any darn good. Well, this particular facility had lots of powerful loudspeakers. They had some of the speakers, the amplifiers loaded at 800 watts, 70 volts, and a couple of them even a little higher than that. And the amps were rated for that, no problem. And they wired it all with 14 gauge. That should be good enough, right? Nice big fat wire. Well, maybe not, because some of the runs were 1,000 feet. Even with 14 gauge wire, that gives you several ohms of DC resistance in the wire. And keep in mind, 70 volts is just a shorthand for not having to do impedance, parallel impedance calculations. So what's an 800 watt load on a 70 volt system? What's the impedance?
About 8 ohms.
About 6.25 ohms. 600 watts would be 8 ohms, 8.3, I think. So is that going to work okay? No. There's going to be big 5 dB wobbles right in the middle of the speech band. This happened to be a big paging system. If you go downtown in the bus tunnel, you can hear it. So in summary, when you're doing a system, think about the impedance of the speaker system. It's not 8 ohms, except at a few special frequencies. Look at the curve. Those curves, even with cheapo speakers like this one, those curves are published. If they're not, pick another manufacturer. There's lots of them around. And don't assume that wire is big enough until you do the calcs. It may not be. Missed a slide. Oh, and this ignores something else called the damping factor. Some loudspeakers, as previous people talked about damping, some loudspeaker designs depend on the electrical damping to quash the back EMF of the loudspeaker. If you need that, you need lots bigger speaker wire than this. Now, fortunately, that doesn't usually occur in a paging system, but it might. And it certainly will in other kinds of systems. Okay, those are my two examples. Any questions? Short and sweet.
All right. I think that does it. Interesting. Thank you very much.